Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, broadcaster Steve Mason talks about getting buried alive.
A guy came along who said, I have a promotional opportunity. And it was a promotion called Buried Alive. And he explained it to me like this. I am going to hypnotize you. Then we're going to literally bury you in a coffin 6 feet under the earth. And we're going to do that for 48 hours. And the idea was that while I was buried alive, I would be raising money to save the Toledo Public Schools athletic programs.
Today on the show, broadcaster Steve Mason talks about getting buried alive as a radio stunt. Stay close.
Hey, my name is Steve Mason, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week with Bassem Youssef. Holy Toledo, what an interesting guy. I don't know if you know Bassem Youssef, Steve, but, you know, he's from Egypt. He was one of the funniest men in Egypt, and in fact, his stories about getting interrogated, because he had a show very much like Jon Stewart. People called him the Jon Stewart of Egypt, and he was on Jon Stewart here in the States. And
I think I remember this story.
It was a big story. And he had to flee the country with his family. He had to split.
Wow.
So it's like a whole thing. And anyway, very interesting, you guys. You have to listen to Bassem Youssef's story. Plus, it's more than that. You know, he's also a heart surgeon, or he was.
Wow.
I know. And now he's a stand-up comic. And that always makes me laugh. Like, you know, people are so talented, so educated. And at the end of the day, why in the world do they want to do stand-up comedy?
Yeah, what an amazing life, though. What a transformation he's had.
Just fantastic. Yeah, really, really cool. So go back and listen, you guys, to Bassem last week, but not today. Stick with me today, because I am here with another really interesting person, a broadcaster, a sportscaster, and somebody I really probably wouldn't have considered having on just because I wouldn't have known you, but for our mutual friends. We've got mutual friends, and they're the ones that said, you've got to get on Steve Mason. And so that's where you came from. And I'm trying to think which friends those are.
It was Sue Kalinske, for sure, was one of them.
Yeah, Sue Kalinske, Monica Piper.
Yes. Did you talk to Paul Provenza? Paul Provenza is a friend of mine.
You know, Paul, funny you should say that, because he still hasn't been on the show. But would you please remind him, because he knows me, I know him, we run into each other, but he's not been on the show. I'd love to have him.
Yeah, I will. And by the way, 600 episodes is unbelievable.
Yeah, you're like 663. I know.
Wow, that's crazy. Congratulations on that.
I started in 2010. I've never missed a week. And in 2014, I did a 5-month period of doing two shows a week. And it was my mistake. It's okay. I learned from it. But like, I was thinking like, well, Howard Stern's on 3 days a week. I listen to Howard Stern 3 days a week. Or Adam Carolla's on 3 days, or he's on 5 days a week. I listen to all of him. Or I think, Mark Maron, he's on twice a week. So, and I was thinking, if they can do it, I can do it, which is not untrue. But for me and my stage in the game, what happened was I was giving my audience a choice of which episode to listen to. Like, do they want to listen to Buried Alive with Steve Mason, or do they want to listen to Getting Interrogated in Egypt with Bassem Youssef?
Boy, they both sound dark, right? Interrogation and being buried alive.
That's why I love my podcast, because it is very honest. And when I ask people to bring a good story, they generally bring a damn good story. And your topic today is buried alive. So first of all, you know, who wouldn't be like on the edge of their seat right off the bat? Like, this is such a cliffhanger. I'm very anxious to talk about it, but I want to hold off because like I never hear people's stories before the show because I do like to hear it for the first time like the listener does.
Sure.
But I'm excited. So just hang on there. But I also want to ask you about your, you know, this whole sports announcer career. You know, you are really a legend, I guess you would say, because you have, first of all, Mason in Ireland is in it's over 25 years, right?
Yeah, I think it's 27 years now that we've been doing the show together in Los Angeles.
27 years on ESPN, or no, it was KSPN LA. It was the number one
yes.
sports talk show. Right. And then, of course, you guys, I think you're still the play-by-play voice for the Lakers. Is that true?
Now, I am not. My broadcast partner, John, is the play-by-play voice for the Lakers. He and I then do the show together every afternoon from 1 to 4, and we've been at ESPN for, I think, 16 years, but we did the show longer on other stations over the years. So it's a total of 27 years.
Yeah, it's a lot of time. And you've covered, you know, everybody, the Lakers, the Rams, the Dodgers, the USC Trojans. And then you've also, of course, worked and announced during the Olympics and random stuff. Like in the Summer Olympics, you were doing the shooting event, right?
Yeah, the shooting events, which was crazy. That's weird. I grew up in central Pennsylvania, and my family, I came from a family of hunters. And so I knew just enough about rifles and shotguns to be able to understand the shooting events. And that's why NBC put me on those.
It's so interesting. I should mention, yeah, you're from Altoona, right?
Yeah, I was born in Altoona and grew up, you said Holy Toledo earlier. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio.
Did you get weighed a lot?
Yeah, that's what Toledo is known for. Glass and,
scales.
Yeah.
That's right. Glass, is that right?
Yeah, it's they call it the Glass City because Libby and Owens Corning were both companies that were based in Toledo. So Glass and Scales.
That's really funny. Libby. Oh my gosh. That reminds me of my mother's bowls and stuff as a child.
Exactly. Exactly. That's where all that stuff came from.
And Corningware. That's almost like Amish dishes.
Very close to the Amish in Ohio. So in Pennsylvania, that's where the Amish are. So yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Well, I'm from Pittsburgh, so I completely know what you're talking about. I know the entire neck of the woods, and my father had a rifle in the back of his closet, and our neighbors hunted, and I remember deers hanging from trees like all the time.
Yep, absolutely. And by the way, we ate that deer. We weren't just hunting for sport. We actually ate the deer venison all winter long. So it was more than just I'm going to go out and shoot a buck. It was, hey, this is going to be part of our, what we eat for the winter.
Well, kids were off school for Christ's sake, you know?
Yeah, no, it was a holiday. The first day of deer season was a holiday. Now I don't notice any Pittsburgh accent for you. You have no Pittsburgh accent.
No, I do not have it. My mother has it. She says I live in Elway.
Elway. Yeah. What are yins done? Are yins gone down to the mall? What's
Get
mom
at.
Doing? All of that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
My
I
mom
love it.
Still reds up the house. Another one.
Oh, yeah. I red up the house. Who doesn't? Yeah. And I wash the dishes. Of course I do. So it's interesting, though, you know, the hunting. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. But that's so funny that that's all you had to do is have a little bit of knowledge of that area, of the tri-state area there. And then they say, okay, then you're the announcer for the shooting event at the Olympics.
That's all it took. I guess Al Michaels did not know anything about shooting, and neither did Bob Costas, so they relied on me. I also did bobsled and luge. That was my other specialty.
And that was
had known nothing.
Yeah, that was in 2002.
Yeah, in Salt Lake. I was the bobsled and luge guy, which is a sport I learned about once I got there. I got to go down the the course in a bobsled with the team. It was an incredible experience. And I really have grown to love those as sports.
So wait a second. Now you're with like, how many other people are in the log?
I was in the middle and there were three other people in it. There was the pilot and then two other people. You have to have multiple people in a bobsled to go down the track.
And then you're in like a suit, a neoprene suit or something?
I was not in a neoprene suit. They were not going full tilt bore. I was not going down at the speed that would have won a medal. They went easy on me.
Okay, so what do they tell you as you're getting into that thing? What are the directions for you? Steve Mason, we're Olympic athletes. You're getting into our boat and...
And I was supposed to wrap my arms around the person in front of me, which I think was purely for safety reasons, and then lean my head down and try to make myself as aerodynamic as possible. I wasn't supposed to lift my chin up. I had to get into that sort of hunched position so that we would be aerodynamic.
Were you scared shitless and did you pray?
I have done lots of stupid stuff in my career and in my life. I've always been an adventurous guy. So no, I thought, hey, here's a great, I always say, I'll try anything once. So I was really excited to do it. And it was a great, great experience.
Okay. So then what happens? All of a sudden you just start moving or do they push off or what happens and how long does it take? And,
yeah.
and you know, just lead me through that real quick. I love this.
Yeah, so I was sitting in the bobsled, and the other guys pushed off. So you probably see how they run along with the bobsled as they get started. Then they all jumped in around me, one person in front of me and two people behind me, and I held on for dear life. It was about 2 minutes that it took to go down the track, maybe a little bit over 2 minutes. And the crazy thing is those turns, yeah. Those curves, you would wind up going sideways in those, almost parallel to the bottom of the track. And again, I think they were going easy on me. I can't imagine what it was to go full speed.
Wow. That is like such a once in a lifetime thing to get to do.
Yeah, it was amazing. And it was really cool because I got to call skeleton. You know, there are three sports. There's bobsled, and then there's skeleton, and then there's luge. Skeleton is where you're on your belly and you're going straight ahead, head first. And so there was an athlete there by the name of Jim Shea, and his grandfather and his father had both won gold medals in sliding events at the Olympics. And here along comes Jim the Third, and I got to call his race where he won his gold medal. And it was such a cool, emotional thing. His grandfather and his dad were both there for it. It was just amazing.
Oh, wow. How interesting. From a snowy place from Colorado or something?
Yeah. Yeah, he was an American. He trained in Colorado Springs and Lake Placid, and he was from Minneapolis.
Oh, good memory. Look at you. This whole thing, you know, being with these top athletes, that must have been, I mean, I always hear about the parties in, you know, Olympic Village and like, you know, there's like always a shortage of condoms or some stuff like
yeah,
that.
Sure.
Is that true?
They do party. The Olympic Village sort of becomes its own experience. And, you know, having talked to athletes who are there, it's sort of a mix of countries. It's a mix of social styles. They definitely drink after their events are over, after they're done competing in the games. The people whose events come really early in the Olympics, they're the ones that wind up having the most fun because then they've got 2.5 weeks where they can just party. But there is a lot of partying at the Olympic Village at any Olympic Games.
Yeah, I've always heard that. That must be a blast.
And, you know, and you mentioned, you know, these athletes. The thing that people don't realize, and I find this from covering, for example, LeBron James, interviewing Michael Phelps over the years. I interviewed Kobe Bryant a bunch of times, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. They are so much bigger and more superhero-like than you would ever expect. Like LeBron James is just an enormous guy and all muscle. Michael Phelps, an enormous guy. And you want to talk about lats and muscle. I mean, just an incredible, incredible athlete. And we forget, we just see them do their race or do their game. And we don't realize from watching on television what magnificent athletes they really are, what magnificent specimens, and the way they have to take care of their bodies.
Well, it's interesting. You're talking about athletes that don't wear a lot of clothes, because I always am so impressed by basketball players and tennis players, because I'm a big tennis fan. I love the way to see them. You know, you can actually see them. Whereas you go to a hockey game and it's just like a big pile of people fighting. You can't follow the puck. Everybody's fighting. There's organ music playing. Any sport with an organ playing, I'm not interested.
No baseball for you, huh?
Well, I try to go to a Dodger game at least once a year. But listen, between you and I, never got to like the seventh inning. I just can't do it. It's too long.
Can't do it.
And also the prices are so stupid. Like, it's not that I couldn't splurge on $200 of drink and food. I could do that, but it pisses me off. I guess because of my Pittsburgh upbringing, I can't give you I'm not kidding you. It'll be $28 for a 16-ounce beer. I'm not kidding you.
It is really expensive. Now, I often go in on a press pass, but I'll tell you what, Dodger games and Los Angeles Rams games, I go to as a fan. I got to go to the Dodgers World Series victory this past, I guess it was October, or it was maybe early November. It was in Dallas, Texas. It was right in the heart of COVID. I never took my mask off, but I am an enormous Dodger fan, and getting to be there was just an incredible experience.
Yeah, I bet. Holy cow. So you've covered so many sports. What do you do for working out and stuff? What do you like?
I have what's called the Devil's Tricycle, which is it's one of those CrossFit bikes where the arms move and the fan blows. If you know what I'm talking about, we call it the spike bike. And then I do a lot of yoga. I was certified as a yoga teacher all the way back in 2000. So I have my own practice and I practice yoga every single day.
Yeah. Awesome. I do as well. But it's funny. I don't call it yoga. I call it stretching. You know what I mean? Like,
I do.
And I do a lot of sit-ups. I try to always like be able to do sit-ups. So I try not to wear, I haven't been wearing jeans like this whole pandemic because I can't. It's hard to do sit-ups in jeans, and if you don't you know, if you have like an elastic waistband, oh my god, I'm getting so old. I'm just saying, you're more likely to lay down and do 25 sit-ups just for fun.
Well, when the pandemic started, I weighed about 200 pounds. I got up to 217 pounds by August because the pandemic was killing me, and I've cut all the way back with exercise and with yoga and with cycling. To get back to 190 pounds. So I technically lost 27 pounds, which I consider to be one of my great accomplishments.
That is an accomplishment. And part of it, I'm sure, is that you can't eat out. You're eating at home?
Eating at home, yes. Eating as healthy as possible. I mean, for all the exercise, you know, what I've learned over the years is that it's really about what you put in your mouth more than anything. So reducing portion sizes and eating, laying off the pasta and the sweets has made all the difference.
I know. It really comes down to like sugar and moderation, but it just like I can be good all day long. Everything's great. And then all of a sudden I'm tired. I'm going to go to bed. But before I do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm just going to have 7 popsicles. You know what I mean? I'll eat four.
For me, it was like, I'll have 2 donuts, which became 3 donuts before bedtime. And we would order donuts to be delivered. And it was just a nightmare.
If you are ordering donuts to be delivered, it is premeditation is what that's called.
Yes, it is. You know you're going to eat them. You know you're going to eat them. And it'll be before breakfast.
Well, listen, I'm so glad you're here. Let's get to your story. But before we do, I wanted to remind everybody that we are playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show, every Friday night live on Facebook and YouTube. And it is so damn funny. It starts at 7 p.m. Pacific time. And we are just having a blast. I've had on amazing guests like Wayne Fetterman and Wendy Liebman, Danny Zucker, Blanka Patch is always there, Melissa Peterman, Marilyn Rice Cub, and on and on. You guys have to come over and watch Story Smash. It's America's new favorite game show that's not quite on television, but you'll see, it will be. You guys can check more out at storysmashshow.com. All right, you guys, he's here right now. You've heard him talking, Steve Mason. You do have a good voice. I'll say that, man.
Well, thank you.
You really do have a nice, smooth voice. You are a sports announcer who has worked extensively in, yes, you guessed it, sports. Now, you can hear him every day now on ESPN on the show Mason in Ireland from ESPN Radio. And like I said, you have covered, it seems like everybody. When you cover the Lakers, the Rams, the Dodgers, the Trojans, is that because you live in LA? Is that why you're covering those teams?
Well, you know, I've been in LA now for 30, I've lived more years in LA than I did back in Ohio. And so over a long period of time, I've adopted those teams. Now, the Rams, I actually grew up as a little kid as a Rams fan. Weirdly, back in the 70s. So I know all the Rams teams from the 70s, and winding up back here and being able to be on the station that actually carries the Rams games is a huge thrill for me. I'm a season ticket holder. Wow. I bought personal seat licenses at the big new fancy stadium. So that's the one that I'm really, really excited about. Dodgers, Lakers, you know, I've been through championships now with them. And USC was there during the 90s, during Pete Carroll winning national championships. So I've just fallen in love with those teams. And although I'm a sports broadcaster, I'm also a fan, and I'm never afraid to let that come through. Like I am, as I've been called, LA's number one fan. I don't necessarily break down the X's and O's. It's about passion, and it's about heart, and it's about love, and it's about everybody that follows the same teams I do.
Yeah, it's a community, really.
Yeah.
Wait, what's the name of the new stadium again here in LA?
It's called SoFi Stadium, and it is spectacular.
I know. I drove by it the other day because I was with a friend who was getting his vaccine at the Forum. And so we passed right by the SoFi Stadium. I thought it was SoFi.
Yeah, SoFi. It's like that financial products company that I see commercials for. So it's SoFi. We got a tour of it, even though there's a pandemic. We got a tour of it, and it is the most amazing stadium I've ever been in. And I've been in lots of them.
Those are big words.
Yeah. Yeah. Even Olympic stadiums. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah. That's exciting. Oh, I can't wait. Now, the other thing is in the 70s, you're telling me you were a Rams fan and not a Steelers fan?
Yes. Cause I was growing up in Ohio, and what happened was,
when did you were born in Altoona, and then when did you move?
Moved when I was really young, So I didn't, although I visited Altoona all the time, I didn't, probably when I was six or seven, I left Altoona and came to Toledo. So my mom was a Steelers fan, or a Stillers fan, as they would say.
Sure.
My dad was a Cowboys fan. My brother was a Raiders fan, and they were in the playoffs every single year. And so I wanted a team that was going to be in the playoffs every year. And the Rams were great during those days. And for some reason, I knew my astrological sign was Aries, which is the Ram. And so I chose the Rams when I was probably 8 or 9 years old to be my team. And it's crazy now that all those years later, I'm out here and I'm at all the Rams games.
Boy, oh boy, what a house divided you guys were.
Yes, we all had different teams. We all had different teams, but one of us generally won it all.
There was something about the 70s in the United States where football was just the thing, right?
Oh, yeah. It took over everything. And still, you know, I mean, if you look at TV ratings, football is still, you know, number one anytime you put it on. But there was something about the 70s when it was smash mouth. It felt old fashioned. It felt like it was all about defense and running backs. And it wasn't the wide open game you see now. It felt like there was an era of football that just felt like a golden era. And I think the 70s were that for the NFL.
Yeah, it was kind of like what college football then became in the 80s and 90s. And now it's all big business. So now it's like really hard. I mean, look, I have other things to do on Sunday. That's my excuse. But I just feel like it's, I don't know. There's too many entertainment choices for your time now.
Yeah, the audience has been divided. The audience has been divided up, and instead of football, you can watch Netflix or watch Amazon Prime or watch any of these other cable networks. So the ratings for everything go down a little bit every year, all sporting events. But it's mostly because there's so much choice. It's like we used to have magazine racks with all those different magazines and different subjects. We have that now for television. And so the audience becomes divided and winnowed down a little bit.
And you know what else that comes down to, Steve? Podcasts.
Yes, absolutely.
Same thing. It's really the same thing. But podcasts, the beauty is you can just have it in your pocket at all times. And it's with you. You know, the person's voice, it's intimate and it's with you. So that's the advantage. And that's the story I'm sticking to.
Yeah, I agree with you. I listen to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah. You also took part in like the IndyCar series, the Grand Prix of Long Beach. That's a big race.
It was a big race. It was incredibly scary for me. I'm not a especially good driver. And we went out to train.
Wait, you didn't have to drive. You weren't a driver.
No, I was a driver in the Celebrity Grand Prix of Long Beach.
I see. I thought you announced it. Oh, I see. They let you be one of the, I get it.
With a bunch of other celebrities. So people like Robert Patrick and the swimmer, Dara Torres. And I mean, all kinds of people were in the race. And
yeah.
I'm not a great driver. So we got out to training and I thought, okay, well, this would be easy. I'll just put it in drive and go. And that's when I found out that this would be driving stick. And I had never learned how to drive stick as a kid. And so while everybody else was learning to race, I was learning to drive stick.
A stick, not just stick. A stick.
A stick, yes. Drive a stick. And so I finished 15th out of 18 drivers, but you know what? Just finishing, I considered to be an achievement. And it's one of the highlights of my whole career was getting to be in that race and finishing.
Wow. That's so cool. I read it as you announced it and I just thought, oh, here's another sport he had to learn, but you actually took part in it. Fun.
Yeah, no, I really had to learn. I had to learn to do it.
Yeah, Adam Carolla always does those, right?
Adam Carolla is one of the big successful drivers. Alfonso Ribeiro is one of the really successful drivers. Yeah, they've all done really well in that race. I am happy to have done it once, but I don't think I'll be invited back.
That's really cool, man. I'm happy for you. Also, you guys, you can find Steve over on Twitter at VeniceMASC. What does that mean? Venice Mace? Math?
Yeah, people call me Mace, M-A-S-E. For Mason, and I live in Venice. So that's sort of my at Venice Mace is my handle.
I'm such an idiot. I made it like it was so cryptic. I don't know. You know what I mean? You know, I just had Greg Fitzsimmons on the show. He lives in Venice too. You know, Craig? I mean, Greg.
Oh, I love it over here. Yeah. I don't know him personally, but obviously know him, but I love living over here. I've lived over here for 20 years now.
Wow. Good for you. Good for you. That's a pretty part of LA for sure.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Steve Mason.
So my story is called Buried Alive and it's everybody's worst nightmare. It's like the thing that you have as a nightmare. Sometimes people will literally think they're, you know, in a coffin under the ground. So I was an FM morning DJ in Toledo. That was my first big part of my career. And I worked for a station called 93QWRQN, or as I would say, as I sounded like back then, 93QWRQN, the DJ voice. And at that point in history, this would have been about 1990, the Toledo Public Schools were having a budget crisis. And they announced that they were going to have to get rid of all of the athletic programs, football and basketball and all of the team sports and individual sports at the high school level. And so I was looking for a way to help to save that. And as a prominent guy in Toledo and as a guy who, you know, had the number one show in the city. And at the same time, a guy came along who said, I have a promotional opportunity. And he had done it a couple of other times. And it was a promotion called Buried Alive. And at first I was unbelievably hesitant because of all the nightmares and because of, you know, this is everybody's worst fear. And he explained it to me like this. I am going to hypnotize you. Then we're going to literally bury you in a coffin 6 feet under the earth. And we're going to do that for 48 hours. And I said, that's crazy. There's no possible way I'm going to do that. That seems like I would never survive it. And ultimately, I kind of put everything together. Toledo Public Schools needed money to save the athletic programs. This opportunity to be buried alive. And I decided I was going to dive into this full on. And the idea was that while I was buried alive, I would be raising money to save the Toledo Public Schools athletic programs. And it was very specific the way it was done. So there was a coffin. First of all, I was hypnotized. And that was, he said, the key to this whole thing was to be hypnotized. And for 48 hours in advance of the start of this, I couldn't eat or drink anything. So I went 48 hours without water, without food, without anything, because there was no way to relieve yourself in a coffin underground. They put me into this coffin.
Oh, God.
They nailed it shut. There was a hole in it. There was a hole in it right over my face. Okay. So I could still see daylight. They lowered me into the ground and covered it completely with dirt, except there was this tube that ran from sort of my face up to the sky so I could actually get air and breathe. And there was a camera inside of the coffin. And so for 24 hours, I was buried in this coffin with air, no food, no water, and a camera on me at all times. And people for the next 2 days showed up and gave money to help the Toledo Public Schools save their sports programs. And it was probably the toughest thing I've ever done. I've done lots of dumb things. I've lived on a billboard and I've done all the sort of FM DJ sorts of things when I was coming up, skydiving with a microphone on and all that stuff. But this was really, really hard. And at the beginning, I thought, okay, I think I'm going to be okay. I think I'm going to be able to get through this. And by the second night, and people are showing up and they can see me on a monitor. They can see what it looks like inside the coffin. And they can see me slowly getting more and more agitated and terrified and closed in and claustrophobic. And finally, I got to the second night of this. And I said, you know what? I don't think I'm going to make it unless you send down a bottle of NyQuil. Because I needed to just knock myself out. And so they dropped a bottle of NyQuil down the tube and I chugged that for the second night. And keep in mind, I was on the air this whole time. I was also I was doing a morning show. I was doing every hour. I would be on the radio saying, hey, come on out, give some money. And so I was broadcasting from down there too. So that bottle of NyQuil is what saved me. That bottle of NyQuil is what knocked me out for that second night, and I was able to survive the night. being on the air helped. Actually talking on the air and talking to people in my head over my headphones helped me to get through it. But ultimately, I did survive it. And I've got to tell you, when they dug me up, and you know, my family was there, and my parents were there, and there was, you know, there were 10,000 people there cheering, or some number of people cheering. And we, it was the strangest feeling. I felt so appreciative of life. I felt so appreciative of the ability to move, the ability to see what was going on in the world. That 48 hours was such a dark and strange and weird period. I would never, ever do this again, never do it again. And I would never advise anybody to do it. David Blaine has done this. Years later, years afterwards, David Blaine was buried alive for 2 days. And I would always think, 2 days, that's nothing, David Blaine. I already did this years ago. But we raised $100,000. And we saved all of the athletic programs in the Toledo Public Schools because I was buried alive. And so that is my story of being buried alive.
Well, the ending is very good.
The beginning is tough.
But yeah, I mean, when you got out of there, oh, fuck yeah, it felt good. I mean, yes.
I felt unbelievable. And you know what? It also felt like, I mean, as weird as it's, I mean, it felt like a great accomplishment, right? I was able to raise all this money and kids were going to be able to play football and basketball and baseball and tennis, which I know is a sport you love, because I was willing to do this and help raise that money. Because it was an oddity that people had never seen and everybody showed up and everybody gave.
Well, yeah, it's Toledo. There's not a whole lot going on, Steve.
Yeah, it was a gigantic deal.
Yeah, what do you want to do today? Well, there's that guy buried down at the park. Okay, let's head down there.
That's really what happened. Yeah.
What were you wearing?
I was wearing shorts and a hoodie because shorts and a t-shirt because I knew it would get very, very warm down there. And I was warned, you know, you're underground. It's going to get warm. It's going to be a little bit harder to breathe. So yeah, just shorts and a t-shirt was all I wore. And it was at the beginning, I thought, okay, this is going to be easy. At the end, I thought, this is going to be impossible for me to survive it. Impossible. But finally getting out of it and knowing that I had raised that money was such a great feeling. And I was, you know, everybody was incredibly excited about it.
Did you pee your pants?
I did not. That's why you couldn't eat or drink for 48 hours leading up to it. Your system had to be completely clear.
Did your stomach growl a lot?
Oh, yeah. Because by the time it was over, I hadn't eaten or had any water in 4 days, except for a bottle of NyQuil. I hadn't eaten or had water in 4 days, which is unbelievably unhealthy.
Well, of course. Yeah. Did you think about the NyQuil beforehand?
No, I did not. Now, I'll tell you, in those days, I got up every morning at 4 a.m. And in order to knock myself out sometimes, at, you know, 10 o'clock at night, because I knew I had to get up early.
Or 9 o'clock at night. I mean, if you have to get up at 3:30, aren't you in bed at 8 o'clock?
Try to. But a lot of times I was not a good sleeper. And so NyQuil, which has alcohol, and again, this is another thing that's not healthy, I would use NyQuil to help me to go to sleep. And so I knew that if I had NyQuil, I would be able to survive that second night and not go completely crazy and say, hey, dig me up, I'm done with this thing. So the NyQuil is actually what saved me at the very end to help me survive to 48 hours.
So did you take breaks? Like, so you were on the air as usual and you did the hourly thing, but not all the time. Cause like when you went, you took the NyQuil, did you say, well, folks, I'm taking some NyQuil. I'm buried under the ground. I'm going down. This is Steve Mason. Good night. Or anything like that?
Yeah, I did have the ability to turn the microphone or turn the camera. So I had a little bit of privacy at some point. And I did do that in the nighttime a lot because it felt creepy having people watch me sleep and just show up and see me sleeping. When I was awake and when I was broadcasting, obviously the camera was on and people were amazed by that. The ability that you could broadcast from underground in a coffin just fascinated people.
Well, it is pretty interesting. I mean, for God's sakes. did you have a light down there then? What was the lighting?
I had a small light, almost like a little reading light. In fact, I remember I was reading a book while I was down there, and I remember exactly what book it was. It was the Gilder Radner book, There's Always Something, which is still, which is such a sweet book and such a, she was such a legend, you know, in comedy and just a beautiful human being. And so I was reading that book while I was down there. So I did have a little reading light.
So you could turn your body how much? How much could you turn?
Not at all. I should get onto my side, either side. But I couldn't, you know, I had probably, I'll say 8 inches above my face, 8 inches above my face.
Yeah.
That's how much clearance I had. So I could turn myself on my side, but that was about it.
Well, this is an insane thing to do. I'm sorry. It just is. Because let's say you had a heart attack down there. I mean, sure. How fast could they dig you out?
Well, I mean, I was 23 years old when this happened. So that was probably not going to happen. There were always people there that were ready to dig me out if I said, that's it. I can't do it. I can't hold up down here. There were always people on hand to dig me out and could get me out quickly if they really needed to, if I lost, because I had been told that other people who had done this stunt had to say, get me out of here. What's interesting about this particular stunt is they used to do it in Hollywood. They did it on Hollywood Boulevard years and years ago, like in the 40s, when they would release a big horror film or they would release a Dracula film. Somebody would actually be buried alive and it would attract attention to the movie. Hey, come see the new Dracula movie or come see the new monster movie. So this particular stunt has got a history to it. So I wasn't the first guy to do it. And there were some other radio guys that do it. And as I mentioned, David Blaine did it a few years later.
Right.
But for me, it was a once in a lifetime, never again. But I'm glad that now, as I look back, I'm glad that I can say I was buried alive and survived it.
Really? Like that was on your bucket list?
Yeah. It wasn't on my bucket list, but look, it, I mean, as you know, from the podcast, it makes a really good story.
I know it definitely does, but you never aspired to do this.
No, but I did aspire to help folks, right? And I did help a bunch of kids play sports and play football and basketball. And I was able to do that. So I did aspire to help people. I also, as I said a little while ago, I always say I'll try anything once. Because I've done lots of dumb stuff over the years in the name of entertainment. So this was just one of the many.
Okay, two more questions. I want to ask the right questions because I know my audience would ask these. If they're whoever's out there listening, I know they're thinking this. Maybe they're not. Maybe it's just me. What did it look like on top of the ground at this point? So you're underneath there. And what is the picture on top of the ground?
Well, they made it look like a grave. So it was sort of that dirt rounded, you know, the way you'd see right after somebody was buried. It's very macabre, right? So it looked exactly like a tomb would look.
And then they had like fanfare. I mean, like, come on over, check out the guy in the earth and pay money. Or what? Did you hear music? I mean, were you underground thinking like, oh yeah, you guys are all up there, you know?
Well,
could you hear anybody?
Well, yeah, people could talk down the tube. So there was this tube that led up to the ground. So people would say, hey, Mace. Hey, how you doing down there? So I would hear people say hello. And of course, my family would stop by and say, are you okay? Are you okay, Steve? Just to make sure that I was surviving it. But Yeah, no. So I could interact with people. I could shout back up the tube. I could broadcast. I was on the air with other people describing what was going on. And I think that was kind of the coolest part of it, was the ability to describe, hey, here's what it is like down here.
Unbelievable. I'll tell you what, Steve. Do you have anything else out of the ordinary? Like, or could you just like run a marathon or do something like that?
You know, I don't think I've got a marathon in me because I did a stunt when I was on Fox Sports West where I attempted to jump over this high bar on live TV. And I came crashing down on my right foot and shattered my right foot. And so I have 9 screws and a plate in my right foot. So marathoning is out of the question for me. See, I've done so many stupid things in the name of entertainment.
But Steve, what made you think you could jump over a pole or whatever?
You know what? I just, as I always say, and it's on YouTube and people joke about it all the time. I just thought I could do it. I didn't think it looked that hard. Yeah, obviously a huge mistake. Not my first and certainly wasn't my last.
Wow. You are so funny. You're such a troublemaker. Do you have children?
I do not. I have 2 dogs that I love and a partner. We've been together for 15 years.
Oh my gosh, how fabulous.
And he doesn't let me do any of this stuff anymore. When the subject of something crazy comes up, he's the one that says, nope, not doing it. And I listen.
I was going to say the loved ones in your life must be like, please stop doing these crazy things.
Yes, they have stopped. They have said that. And I have absolutely stopped.
And you live in beautiful Venice, California. When I was talking to Greg Fitzsimmons, we were saying that it's like, he's like, yeah, I can go down and hit paddle tennis. And then I jump in the waves and I run home. I have a hot tub and then I cook out. And I'm thinking, there's no reason for you to go anywhere. You are in perfect. It's like a vacation all the time.
Yeah, it is absolutely beautiful to be able to walk out your door and a half a mile from the beach and be able to barbecue. And I've got a beautiful yard and I'm really close to the water. And yeah, no, life is really, really good. It's treated me really well. I'm super blessed.
Oh, I'm so, so glad. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for joining me here on Storyworthy. I will have to start listening. I'm not a big sports person or as big, but I'm definitely going to start listening to you guys. Actually, I listened to you in Ireland a couple of days ago preparing for this. And boy, it really is high energy. You guys are high energy.
Yep. Yes, we are. That is energy is what we've got, enthusiasm, because we get to play in the fun and games department. We don't have to talk about serious stuff. Hey, can I mention one other thing?
Please, yeah.
So Sue Kalinske, who's been on your show and who recommended me to you, she and I do a podcast, plug my podcast. It's called Culture Pop. And we talk to actors and directors, people like Glenn Turman from Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Bryan Cranston has done the show. Larry King did the show a couple of times. Christopher McDonald from Happy Gilmore did the show. Tyler James Williams is the current one from The United States versus Billie Holiday, which is a great movie. So it's called Culture Pop, and you can just search it on iTunes or Spotify.
I'm so excited. Culture Pop. That's awesome. I can't wait to listen. And yeah, Sue is a fantastic talent as well. So boy, oh boy, you guys, man, this is just like, I hit the jackpot when I met Sue Kalinske. I hit the jackpot.
I did too. You know, she and I did that show together in New York. We did a show for about 2 years on WNEW in New York. So that's how Sue and I became such close friends.
And what was that show again?
That was called The Anti-Show with Steve Mason and Sue Kalinske. And we had a lot of fun. It was a morning drive show. It started at 5 a.m. every day. We went till 10 a.m. Monday through Friday. And we did that for about 2 years. It was a really fun show.
That sounds like so much fun. Sometimes I really regret not trying to do the radio path. I mean, I've been podcasting and it's definitely in the vein of that. And anytime somebody gives me a microphone, I'll take it. But I never got to work for a radio station. I never did that.
Well, you know, the beauty of podcasting is, you know, we're allowed to talk for about 8 or 9 minutes, and then we have 5 minutes of commercials.
Sure.
The beauty of podcasting is you don't have those interruptions. You know, people have a sponsor or a couple of sponsors or whatever that is, but you don't have to take 5 minutes away for five different commercials. And so doing a podcast, and I found this with Culture Pop, it's very liberating to not have to worry about stopping all the time.
No, I get it. And I've seen, you know, I've seen DJs working, and I've seen, you know, I used to be a big fan. I don't know if you ever heard of Doug Hirth. Maybe you heard of Doug Hirth because he was in Pennsylvania, outside of, in Pittsburgh, actually. Anyway, he had a talk show on for years, and I would go in and just hang out with Doug and watch him record. And I would see the producer like dropping numbers, like 5, 4, dropping numbers from his little sound booth. And the numbers he was dropping was how many times Doug Hirth had to say the call letters or whatever, you know, like he had to say the call letters 5 times every 30 seconds. And so the producer in the little closet would be, and he had the cards back then, those cards, they would be switching around. I just found it all fascinating, and I never got to work in it. And I know what you're saying. It would be more restrictive, but I also think there would be a power to that, like in terms of, you know, cut to that, go to that, move to that. It's just, I don't know. I want to try that someday.
Yeah, you should try that someday. And especially now, you know, especially with NPR and with talk radio the way it is, you know, there are obviously ways to get into it, and you should try it. You would be great at it, I think.
Yeah, I'll have to pick your brain because you would think it would be easy and with my experience, but you can't even get anything read or looked at there at some of those venues. You can't even get it looked at. So if you don't have a connection, in other words, when you send things unsolicited,
yes,
they're not even paying any mind. So it's just, so I don't have any names. So
I'll be your connection.
Cool. Good. I think you could vouch for me. I think they would say, Steve Mason, let me think. Oh, yeah, I know that guy.
Yeah, and I'll say I did an hour with Christine, and she's fantastic.
This has been a blast. I love that Getting Buried Alive story, really. I was on the edge of my seat. I just kept thinking, don't do it. Just quit. Just say no. So insane. It was just awesome. All right, listen, you guys, we got to wrap it up. Find Steve over there at Venice Mace, VeniceMase. Of course. And then find me over there on Twitter as well at Storyworthy. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of the very talented Steve Mason. Thank you so much, friend. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a Storyworthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.